Hello, and welcome to the seventh episode of NASP's podcast on equity, diversity, and inclusion within school psychology. I am Shayla Desai, the NASP Director of Educational Practice. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm honored to be the host of this series. This episode will focus on the history of cognitive assessment and its particular impact on individuals from minoritized backgrounds, as well as how this impacts current practice for school psychologists. Today, I'm joined by guests Dr. Candace Aston and Mr. Oscar Grajeda. Candace and Oscar, could you please briefly share a bit about your current role and anything you're comfortable sharing about your identities, including areas of intersectionality? Candace, why don't we start with you?
Hi, I'm Candace Aston, and I am an assistant professor at Towson University. I'm also a licensed psychologist and currently work in private practice as well. My pronouns are she, her. And in regards to my research, I have been heavily focusing on culturally responsive assessment and intervention practices, specifically for Black children.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Oscar Grajeda, and I go by he and him, and I'm a bilingual school psychologist, and I practice here in San Diego, California. I'm also part of the adjunct faculty at San Diego State University, and a lot of my passion and the work that I like to do surrounds with assessment of culturally and linguistically diverse students and multiculturalism. Thank you.
Thank you both for being here. Candace, I'm going to direct the first question to you. Can you share why is it important for school psychologists to understand the history of intelligence testing within the United States?
Sure. I believe it's really important for school psychologists, as well as the field of psychology, to recognize the complicated history between intelligence testing and Black and Brown communities. While not the original intention of Binet and Simon, when IQ testing really emerged in the United States, it was used as a tool to further perpetuate false ideology that Black people were intellectually inferior to their white counterparts. The unfortunate part of that is that the assessments that were used to perpetuate these claims were often found to be biased, did not include people from minoritized backgrounds in regard to norming samples. And it was really designed, those testing instruments were really designed through a Eurocentric lens that unfairly placed Black people who took these tests at a disadvantage. In fact, these same issues with IQ testing have emerged over and over again by several Black pioneers in psychology, like Albert Beckham, who is considered our first Black school psychologist, and Dr. Robert Williams, who designed the Black intelligence test of cultural homogeneity to counter the claims of Black inferiority in regards to testing. IQ testing is also what prompted ABSI, the Association of Black Psychologists, to file the Larry P. versus Rouse case in the state of California to stop the use of IQ testing with Black children. And this was really prompted due to the high numbers of Black children that were qualifying for special education due to low scores on IQ measures. What all of these people, as well as the organizations, have in common is that they understood the harm and negative outcomes that could stem from the use of bias assessment tools. And if we fast forward to now, I believe there are still school psychologists that are having these same discussions with themselves in regard to cultural bias and IQ testing, given that things such as disproportionality has not gone away and continue to exist nationally for Black and Brown students. I believe that by knowing the history behind the tools that school psychologists heavily rely on, like IQ tests, that will allow practitioners to have a greater understanding of the mistrust that some of the communities that we work with may have towards our profession. And it's really why it's up to each one of us to work on repairing that harm and challenging our current practices to ensure they don't do more harm to children and communities that already face many challenges. But it really starts with knowledge and recognition. And similar to APA's apology to Black and Indigenous people of color that recently came out, I think it's really important for the school psychology to also do the same.
Thank you. You bring up a lot of good points, and thank you especially for sharing all of that history. Knowing this history, how do you view the current state of assessment practices as it pertains to Black students in particular, but minoritized students maybe in general as well? And do you feel like we're making progress?
Yeah, I think there are some ways in which we're making progress. Based on a recent survey study that I conducted, I surveyed current practitioners and asked them some questions in regard to what their current assessment practices look like as it pertains to Black students. And what I found from the survey is that current practitioners do believe that overall, there are some cultural bias that exist in the tools that we use. They also express greater knowledge about what tests might be more appropriate for various for students from various different cultural groups. However, where the disconnect came in when reviewing the data from the survey is that despite having greater understanding regarding cultural bias and assessments and which tests might be better for one student population versus another, it did not quite translate to practice. So for example, many of the practitioners expressed utilizing nonverbal assessments or assessments such as the KABC to assess students from minoritized backgrounds. However, when I asked them what is their day-to-day test battery, when they actually test Black and Brown students, a lot of them reported that they typically stick to Wechsler assessment. So while I think as a whole, in terms of training graduate students, we're definitely moving to an understanding that students need to have a greater understanding of the various assessment tools, it's just not quite transferring to the day-to-day practices. And I think there could be many reasons for that. I understand the barriers that practitioners face in terms of what tools might be readily available to them in their district. But I think if we really want to be in alignment with anti-racist practices, we can't allow ourselves to let these barriers keep us from conducting assessment and evaluations the way we feel best benefits the child. One takeaway that I personally had from my survey is that what we are doing in regard to the assessment and evaluation of Black children really isn't working. The current state of assessment isn't working. And we see that it's not working because the high rates of disproportionality still exist. Black children are still being left out of gifted and talented programs. And the achievement or opportunity gap, as some people refer to, still exists. So I think in terms of progress, yes, there's progress, but not enough for us to kind of stop advocating for change in regards to our practices.
Yeah, it sounds like we have a long way to go. And I also appreciate earlier you kind of had, you know, the call to action for the field at large to kind of own up to how some of these historical practices have really impacted youth today and kind of our need to have ownership over that so that we can move forward and continue to make progress. So as a segue, you mentioned, you know, there's hope for the future. I understand that you both teach assessment courses with school psychology graduate students. So what advice would you have for school psychology programs to teach assessment within this historical context? So any tips you might have? Oscar, why don't we start with you this time?
Sure, thank you. I think in terms of, I've had the great opportunity of, I'm a graduate of San Diego State's program, and our emphasis has always been on multiculturalism, understanding your biases, and how culture and language are assets. And I often find that that's usually one of the things that is left out of most graduate programs. We often talk about Bronfenbrenner's ecological model, and I think that's a huge aspect in terms of, you know, understanding the emphasis as a contribution of culture and language, and thinking really more from a deficit-based to a strength-based model. Part of what we want to, you know, pass down to other graduate students, especially in terms of multiculturalism and really understanding how to work with students that are from diverse backgrounds, is really looking at alternative approaches. You know, I know here in California, we have a very unique situation in terms of how do we assess Black students without the use of IQ assessments, but really looking at dynamic assessment, for example, is a huge, huge part of our program at San Diego State. And it really taps into really looking at thinking skills that can be mediated, you know, and depending on the examiner and really, you know, what they see and how to best assist that child. I think one of the biggest things for me, though, is you know, passing on to most graduate students is that our job is, you know, not just assessment for eligibility. And I feel like, and, you know, just in practice, like myself right now, I consistently see that most of our assessments are only for eligibility. Instead, the focus should always be about assessment for intervention. And I think more importantly for our Black and Brown students, given, you know, the disproportionate rates that are present at this time. So.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think you bring up a good point about testing for intervention. And we know with some of these standardized assessments, you know, there's not a clear direct link between those assessments and direct intervention. So, you know, I totally hear what you're saying. Candace, anything that you'd like to add?
Sure. When working with my graduate students, one thing that I really try to relay to them is that the assessment process, looking at testing is just one piece of the puzzle. I think so many times as school psychologists, we think the tests are the only way to get valuable information, similar to what Oscar was saying, like taking a more dynamic approach. But with that, I also see us kind of not even doing some of the practices that were so ingrained in through our graduate program. So if we think of RIOT, you know, record review, interviews, observations, and I have reviewed so many evaluations where a parent wasn't even talked to in regard to making such an important decision, like their child entering special education. And when it comes to Black and Brown students particularly, I think we even see less of those steps being followed, less interviews with parents, less getting parents rating scales. And I understand, again, the barriers that may exist when working with high-risk populations. But again, I think we have to continue to challenge ourselves to figure out not, you know, why they're not doing it, but what has happened to those parents and the people from those communities that led to them having this mistrust towards us and maybe our profession as a whole, and youth evaluation as almost an opportunity to repair the trust, and that, you know, maybe, you know, making extra calls to those parents, doing home visits, things that we can do and we know we can do, but I don't think we always do. So I would say definitely parent outreach is especially important for our Black and Brown communities, and even just advocating to help them fully understand what they are signing when they're signing things in the meeting. So I also view our job as, you know, making sure parents fully understand the special education process and doing that psychoeducation piece. Another thing from kind of a trainer standpoint, even thinking about the tools in which you have at your graduate program. My first year, I realized that we had no tests that kind of were really normed or designed for different cultural groups, such as Spanish speakers. So that, you know, took me to look into different assessments so that even if a student wanted to kind of vary away from, you know, a traditional Wechsler assessment, they can do it because we have the tools to do that. So a simple fix is kind of just like taking an audit. What tests do you have available to your students? If you only have, you know, this limited amount of tests that don't really speak to diverse cultures, then maybe that's a start there.
Thank you both. Yeah, those are really helpful tips. I think, you know, I'm hearing the parent outreach is so critical, looking at the whole child, looking from a strengths-based perspective, dynamic assessment, all of these pieces are really important to have these culturally responsive assessment practices. So thank you. Oscar, so I understand you're a current practitioner as well as a graduate instructor. Can you share what are some of the key ways that non-discriminatory assessment translates to everyday practice for school psychologists?
So in terms of the way that usually translates, at least in the current practices that I see, and again, here in California, you know, we're in a very unique situation just because we're not allowed to give IQ tests, which, you know, at least, you know, I'll speak only for myself here. I'm really more in line with, you know, not necessarily use an IQ test. And given the fact that there's a lot of this research has come out in terms of the limited diagnostic utility of some of these tests. So really, in terms of what I see a lot of, you know, school psychologists here in California tend to use is they use a lot of the CHC theory and use different tests to measure specific areas as they relate to the theory, to the theoretical background. I think there has to be a push for, you know, less of a final determination, just using purely standardized measures. And that's kind of really where I see our field is very still stuck in, at least here in California. As I said before, and, you know, Candace alluded to a lot of these things too, in terms of the strength-based approach, using culture as protective factors. And Candace hit it right on the head in terms of the amount of time that's spent on standardized assessment limits most school psychologists in really looking at the records and the interviews and the observations. I have actually found that when I look at, you know, evaluations from other psychologists, it's almost backwards. It's almost like they do the testing portion first and they kind of go through everything else after. You know, I caution folks to do that because, again, we're spending a lot of limited time working with the parents. You know, how often do we actually do home visits when we can't get a hold of parents? I mean, can the study really, really brought out to light that, yes, most of us, you know, attempt to do those things. And, you know, sometimes we send rating scales home. And I understand, you know, we're all pressed for time sometimes. But I would argue that the less time we spend on sometimes on standardized measures, we can spend more time interviewing the parents and really getting to know developmental history using play-based assessment. I know here in California, we at the Diagnostic Center of Northern California had came out with a matrix that guided practitioners in using play-based assessment to really look at these very specific skills as they relate to, you know, like cognition, social cognition, some executive functioning skills. But I also think that part of what we struggle with sometimes is skill-based assessments, you know, and again, because they are the ones that drive intervention. I would argue that if you were to ask most school psychologists in terms of if they really look at the data they've gathered from cognitive assessment or processing assessment, whatever tools they use, how many times that they've actually shown up to an IEP meeting and that's informed intervention. And I would argue that it really hasn't, versus outside of your, you know, your traditional phonics or phonological awareness issues. The last couple of things that, you know, that I stress too is adaptive skills. I know the Larry P case, that was one of the areas that was mandated for school psychologists to assess was adaptive skills. And I rarely, if ever, see any adaptive measures really looking, you know, to really measure those skills for Black and Brown students. And ultimately, you know, we have to consider not only what happens at school, but bridging really what happens in the home and the community, because those are all huge factors that really help paint the picture of who the child is and what their needs are. So.
Thank you. That's helpful. So just a follow-up question. Given the limited and conflicting research on processing disorders and intelligence as a prediction of achievement, what can California's regulations and their non-discriminatory assessment practices teach us about evaluations that don't over-rely on IQ and achievement? You know, essentially, what have we learned from the Larry P versus Riles case?
Sure. Or Candace, do you want to take this one first? Or do you want me to do it?
You can go ahead.
Sure. I think the big thing, again, though, it goes back to, like, I think we have to focus on skills that we can actually see and measure progress. You know, I often think about reading, writing, and math. Obviously, behavior is always something that we're still trying to figure out how to monitor and really determine whether, you know, students are making progress. But, you know, I often find that we don't focus enough on skills that drive interventions. I also think that we have to understand the limitations of a lot of the tools that are out there. And I think what ends up happening a lot of the times, and a lot of, you know, and not to anyone's fault, but most of the graduate programs and the way that that teach their graduate students, and really in terms of going out into the field, and I think Candace pointed this out, sometimes that doesn't transfer, you know, so you could be taught something in your program and you go out and the district in itself has policies in place and you have to follow those policies. And as much as you try to kind of find some wiggle room around that, unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't work. So, you know, obviously in terms of really what should we be looking for and what can we learn from Larry P is, despite the fact that even here in California, we're not allowed to use IQ tests, you know, there's still continue to be huge disproportionate numbers for Black and Brown students. So I don't know if we've learned much from that, to be honest. I feel like our practices here, despite Larry P, continue to be antiquated. You know, so I feel like there has to be, we have to continue making a bigger shift in terms of really looking at, you know, can we figure out what the student needs in terms of the skills and things that we can actually measure and figure out how do we support with that?
Yeah, thank you. Candace, did you have any thoughts to add to that regarding the Larry P case?
Sure. When I think of the Larry P versus Rouse case, I think that it did teach us that we shouldn't have a heavy reliance on assessments. It brought out some of the issues in regards to how tests are constructed and things like that. So I think it was a great example that we need to pay attention to the tests, the tools that we're using. However, I think where we are as a field is that we haven't figured out what to replace that method in. Okay, so if we're not using assessments, what do we use instead? And I think that's where we're grappling with. I was alluding to a qualitative interview study that I did with practitioners, and I posed the question to each of them, what does it mean to be non-discriminatory? What is a non-discriminatory assessment? And everyone really struggled with trying to kind of provide a response to kind of what that is or what that looks like. So I think we need as a whole field greater guidance on how to make those steps to ensure that we're being non-discriminatory. And if we're not using assessments, how do we use other things to help make these eligibility decisions?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that is definitely the biggest hurdle is what do we substitute with? You know, our training programs have taught us that there are these set options. And so if we're not going to stick to those, then what do we do instead? I think that's a really great point. Candace, I know you've done some research in this area. So I want to ask you, is it ever appropriate to break standardization practices when assessing students, any student really, but especially students from minoritized backgrounds?
Yeah, and I think that's a very difficult, you know, question to answer in regards to, you know, advocating for, you know, to break standardization, especially in our field as a school psychologist. But what I think about when you ask that question is that it really comes down to clinical judgment, which to a certain extent, all assessments require. So when I was interviewing practitioners that work with predominantly Black and Brown students, I found that the issue of adhering to strict standardization procedures was a theme that arose in regards to an area of difficulty. Those who work more with Black and Brown students found kind of the need to veer away or to kind of provide some additional strategies or approaches to assessment with that specific student population. So for instance, issues regarding how some test items were worded or how directions were presented was identified as an area that their students had difficulty with. And in those cases, the practitioners used their clinical judgment to determine that the student's inability to complete the task was not a skill deficit, but it had more to do with language, and it prompted them to provide alternative directives. And to me, that's what standardization, like when we're talking about this discussion, we're not necessarily saying like you go and make up the directions to the task yourselves. It's more like when you have this kind of feeling and you know, because you know the student population, you know the community, and you know kind of the role of culture and how that plays within the whole child, that might prompt you to kind of make some additional adjustments throughout the process. So in regard whether it's appropriate or not, that's a hard question to answer. However, I think about it just as we allow clinical judgment to determine whether a score to an answer is a 0 or a 2 based on when we have an answer from a student that's not exactly in the manual, we allow for that clinical judgment. So I think, you know, we give that guidance to practitioners to also make that call for themselves. But I also believe for school psychologists to really to kind of have that culturally sound clinical judgment is something that comes through work. And in order to be able to make that call of, oh, maybe I should adjust these directions or things like that, it really comes from greater cultural competence.
Yeah, that cultural competence as well as experience, I would think, you know, I feel like after you've given a whisk 150 times, you get a sense of like, these are the common areas of error, so to speak, or, you know, we realize that we can't really ask what is a stamp anymore because children don't really understand what that is anymore. So those kinds of things, I think we better understand with, as you mentioned, like appropriate training as well as experience. That's helpful. And I totally agree too, that it's really hard to say like, yes, there are cases where you can break standardization, but having that clinical judgment and that flexibility in the moment is also so important. I have another question for both of you. There is, as I'm sure you know, increasing attention on the role of implicit bias when it comes to culturally responsive practice. How does this bias impact the assessment process in particular? Oscar, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I think implicit bias, you know, in many ways can cloud clinical judgment and decision making. You know, I think a lot of it goes back to, understanding like what tools we want to use. I know Candace was speaking to this, and, you know, so were you, Sheila, in terms of, you know, knowing that, you know, for example, the WISC has some of these items that, you know, children may not be exposed to anymore. How fair is that really, and really looking at whether they know if that's part of their knowledge bank? But I also feel like, you know, having, you know, personal biases also influence that. I often talk to my students about, you know, the confirmatory bias really is, you know, you, by the time you've done your record, you're going to be the parents, you've done the observations, you kind of are going in with a sense of, you know, some sort of biases there. Oh, well, I've seen this kid struggle throughout the time, and I'm probably going to see some of these issues. But I think what we need to reshape our focus and really look at how affected we are by those biases, because again, not having those in place really does affect the outcome for students. I have often found that when people already have these inherent biases about a student's behavior or their academic struggle, it can be anything but the child's problem. You know, we often don't forget about, could it be something else? Could it be anything in the environment or anything in the instruction? So I think that's something that we have to always consider.
Thank you. Candace, what are your thoughts?
I believe that implicit bias is really at play at all stages of the evaluation and assessment process. And I think there are some things that, you know, practitioners can think about. I know as a practitioner in the school, sometimes before I even opened a record for a child, I was already told what my decision is going to be. And some of those, like Oscar was saying, in terms of confirmatory bias, I definitely think that that's something we have to be cognizant of. Things that I have done to try and kind of eliminate or kind of reduce some of the bias is sometimes I will assess a student before looking at rating scales for parents and teachers, or before talking and doing my interviews with the teachers, so that I kind of don't have that picture kind of so that I don't have the picture that the parent or the teacher painted for the child to cloud kind of some of my judgment of the child. And I think that is important because bias is something that everyone has, everyone needs to confront at all stages of, you know, no matter where you are in terms of your cultural competence. I think we all have biases and we all have to readily challenge them. So I would say, yes, there's definitely implicit bias in regard to assessment, and it can show up anywhere. I don't think we can say it's in this part or it's in that part. It's everywhere. And I think you should always be asking yourself, you know, where bias can come in and how can I reduce it? How can I challenge this? And that becomes what's kind of the self-work that we all have to do.
Absolutely. Thank you. So my last question is also for both of you. Overall, what advice do you have for the field in terms of using assessment in a culturally responsive way, and also as a tool for active anti-racism work? Where do you feel that the field needs to go in this regard, and how do you think we would get there? Candace, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So in regard to how we can use assessment to move towards kind of more anti-racist practices, I think one of the biggest things, and I hear it daily from my interns as well as my practicum students, is that they are confronted with a student who is struggling, it could be behaviorally or academically, and they're almost sold this idea that the only way to help them is special education. So I think in terms of using assessment for good is that we have to go back to thinking about assessment as not just the pathway to special education, but like Oscar was saying, assessment can be linked to intervention. Thinking outside the box, how can we help students who are struggling in ways that in which that we don't have to go through special education, because not all of these children really warrant special education. And this is even more important now that we're kind of still in the midst of a pandemic. And there was a lot of learning loss. There was a lot of equity issues in regards to the pandemic. And we can't allow ourselves to see these learning losses as, you know, an open door to special education. So with my students, I have been advocating for thinking about what ways you can support students, how can you build up your tier two interventions at your school? How can we run reading groups and other alternative ways before jumping to special education? And I kind of alluded to it before, but I think my other kind of advice overall is just really about doing your own self-work before you can truly work with students from different cultures and understand and have that cultural humility. You have to do the work yourselves. You have to have a good understanding of your own cultural background and your own cultural lens and how your identities intersect to have a greater ability to kind of see how those impact students in the schools.
Thank you. Oscar, what are your thoughts?
Sure. I think the first thing that I think is I don't want to minimize, you know, the fact that this is a lot of hard work to do. You know, I have often found that assessment of children tends to be the easy part, but really like being involved in, and as Candace kind of was talking about, being involved in our tier two, I would even, you know, go as far as saying our tier one and really, you know, assisting teachers and really understanding how to infuse, you know, culturally responsive instruction. Because I think that's really takes a lot of work and helps shift that, you know, that perspective of, you know, my one of my professors, the late Dr. Valerie Cook Morales, always spoke about that there are problem situations, not problem children. And to me, that always resonated with me because it often spoke to really looking at what else we can do in controlling the environment and really and assist kids with in order, you know, to find some support with. Now, the other thing that I would also talk about is focusing on developing cultural competencies. And I think Candace spoke about this. You know, I have often found that, you know, it isn't until you really challenge yourself and really what you think about and the information that you're pushing out to the students you work with or the staff that you work with, that's the only way to really get a true understanding of how to assist students. And also, too, I think the last thing I would say is, our assessments have to be conducted with culture and language at the forefront. You know, we want to use them as assets. And I find that when you look at it from that perspective, the shift does happen because you use that strength and not look at it as like, oh, this is something that's contributing to the, you know, to this child's problem, but instead focusing on this contributes to really their success in school as well.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. Thank you both. I think this information is so helpful. Candace and Oscar, I very much appreciate the time that you spent here today. It's been so informative to hear your thoughts, and we very much appreciate you sharing both your knowledge and your experiences with us. For everyone listening, thank you for joining and taking an interest in these important issues. We hope you'll tune in next time for the last installment of this year's EDI podcast. For more information on EDI topics and social justice, please check out the NASP website. Thank you.